This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, May 22nd, 2014. I'm Christina Karnatz.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. The KUAF Fulbright Chamber Music Festival continues its season with the String Quartet by Grieg, a single movement quartet by Schubert, and the Dvorak Sextet for Strings tonight at 7:30 in the Stella Boyle Smith Fine Arts Concert Hall. Performers include the U of A Music Department faculty and guest artists. Admission free. FulbrightSummerMusic.uark.edu. For more information.
Ahead, a conversation with the Director of Special Education for the U.S. Department of Education, who says many with disabilities are fully capable of learning anything and everything that those without disabilities can.
And as strawberries begin to pop up in gardens and farmers markets in the area, a group of national leaders in the industry meet in Fayetteville to discuss sustainable growing practices.
But first, the results of five down-ballot legislative races may have serious implications for the private option, which requires an annual vote. Arkansas's modified Medicaid expansion plan, providing insurance to over 150,000 low-income residents, narrowly passed earlier this year. Jay Barth, a political scientist at Hendricks College, notes the program has been contentious in Republican primary races.
The most important of these is the race up in north central Arkansas between John Burris and his anti-private option opponent, Mr. Flippo, that's going to a runoff. And I think that's an important race because not only does it mean a potential vote shift on the private option, but I think it's of symbolic importance because of John Burris's role in helping to create this bipartisan approach in the first place. And so I think that's a crucially important race.
Burris of Harrison is one of three proponents of the private option vying for a state Senate seat. Bill Sample held on to his seat while Bruce Holland lost to a vocal opponent of the program. The Senate had no votes to spare during its last vote. The House had one to spare this year, and private option supporter Sue Scott of Rogers held on to her seat against an opponent of the plan, Dane Zimmerman.
This week's election marked the first statewide test of Arkansas's new voter ID law, and complaints are surfacing that poll workers incorrectly use IDs as an impediment to voting. Arkansas attorney Holly Dickinson with the ACLU says reports from around the state have been coming in since early voting began.
Poll workers were not only being inconsistent in their enforcement or non-enforcement of the voter ID law, but in some cases were overreaching and going outside the scope of the authority that the law gives them. And we're actually basically pop quizzing voters about the information listed on any identification that they presented that was not provided for in the voter ID law.
However, Justin Clay, director of the State Board of Election Commissioners, says they have not been presented with claims of improper voter ID requirements.
We have not received any complaints from voters. However, we have communicated to the county election commissioners and various other election administrators just to remind them what the proper procedure is for processing voters and assessing the photo ID.
Dixon of the ACLU says the organization plans to file a complaint with the Board of Election Commissioners soon.
With Republican voters choosing Bruce Westerman to represent the party in the 4th District congressional race, Democrat James Lee Witt is stepping up his campaign. A TV ad is hitting the airwaves featuring former President Bill Clinton. Witt served as director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency during Clinton's time in office. The ad features images of the Oklahoma City bombing and recent footage of Witt on his farm. The Democrat has had a relatively low profile while Republicans battled for the GOP nomination. Officials at Arkansas Tech University in Ozark later this year will break ground on a new building for its allied health programs. According to the college, the more than 20,000 square foot facility will house the school's paramedic, health information technology, physical therapist assistant, practical nursing, and registered nursing programs. Construction is expected to begin in October. Combined with maintenance to the campus's administrative support building, the project represents $6 million worth of investments in the campus.
Tuition will be going up for many of the state's colleges next academic year. The University of Arkansas System Board of Trustees voted yesterday to increase tuition at the system's 10 campuses. According to the UAA System Board documents, tuition at the main campus in Fayetteville will increase by 5%, an increase of about $13 per credit hour. Tuition at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith will increase 6%, or $11.27 per credit hour.
The Razorback baseball team again moves forward in the SEC baseball tournament. Yesterday, the 20th-ranked Arkansas defeated Ole Miss 2-1. The Razorbacks face the 8th-ranked LSU Tigers today in Hoover, Alabama.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals returned to Arvest Ballpark in Springdale yesterday. The Nats lost their series opener to the San Antonio Missions 2-0. The loss puts the Naturals at 12 games under 500 for the season. The series will continue tonight in Springdale.
Tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with overnight lows from 62 in northwest Arkansas to 65 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny with a slight chance for showers in northwest Arkansas, highs from 82 to 85. Tomorrow evening, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, lows in the mid-60s.
This is Ozarks at Large. A year ago, the Strawberry Sustainability Initiative awarded, through the University of Arkansas Systems Division of Agricultural's Center for Agricultural and Rural Sustainability, 20 grants in 13 states. The idea behind the approximately $2.6 million in grants? Expand and strengthen sustainable strawberry growth in places where strawberry production has been reduced or limited in the past few decades. When the initiative, made possible with a $3 million gift from the Walmart Foundation, was announced last year, Kurt Rome, a horticulture professor for the University of Arkansas's Division of Agriculture, explained the strawberry industry had shifted over time. He told us then the majority of strawberries available commercially in the U.S. basically come from two small patches of real estate, one in Florida and one in California. Other states, like Arkansas, that used to produce strawberries no longer did so in large numbers, because farming techniques had changed.
So you'd plant strawberries and you'd cultivate them and you'd grow them as a continuous crop that might last 6 to 9 years. But in the 1980s, some new technologies came up. They were developed mostly on the West Coast, and it was based on some entire new genetics for strawberries. Strawberries only flower once a year. The traditional strawberry only flowers once a year, and therefore it would only produce in the spring for a very short period of maybe 3 or 4 weeks. There was some breakthrough in genetics, which allowed strawberries to be continually flowering, continuously blooming, so therefore continuously cropping.
The new way of growing strawberries was best suited for a few counties in Florida and California. The 20 projects awarded money last year are designed to help expand strawberry growth across the country. And yesterday, the project leads from each of the grantees gathered at the Chancellor Hotel in downtown Fayetteville to discuss their progress. Kurt Rome says 1/4 of the grant recipients are working on the very idea of expanding the season of production and reintroducing strawberries to states like North Carolina and New Jersey. But he says the entirety of the projects run the gamut from production to sustainability.
We have two projects that are related to developing new strawberry varieties, particularly for the eastern and the southeastern United States. Most strawberry varieties are now very privately owned. And they're owned by companies that tightly protect those as trade secrets, and they will grow them on contract with growers. And over the last 25 years, we've not had the introduction of public varieties that growers would have access to. So we have two projects that are testing varieties and developing varieties that I think will have a big impact to us. We have a number of tests at how do we conserve water resource? And some of this new technology really is good at water preservation and water conservation. We have several projects that are focused on reducing chemical inputs, whether that be pesticides for insect and disease control, and also fertilizers and soil fumigants.
Strawberries as a crop have some limitations. The fruit has a very short shelf life before the optimum taste begins to fade. Rome says developing markets in more locations can make the crop more palatable for longer to consumers and reduce costs associated with getting strawberries to the market.
Carbon footprint for transportation is a significant issue, and not just the carbon footprint, but because of the long transportation distances, we have about 20 to 30% spoilage from the time it's harvested before a consumer can actually pick it up off the shelf. And to think that we waste that much food is a strong sustainability issue. by reducing that transportation distance, strawberries that have a shelf life from harvest till consumption of about 7 days, if we take 2 to 3 days off of the transportation, we essentially doubled the retail life of a strawberry. That will reduce that spoilage. That makes more strawberries available to consumers. It'll make them be able to be harvested riper, more nutritious, and a higher quality product as well.
The 20 presentations yesterday provided updates on the studies underway at schools like Kansas State, the University of California, and the University of Florida. The initiative is truly coast to coast, but perhaps more importantly, it's border to border, north to south.
We have a project in Minnesota, and it's an excellent project creating kind of really good grower tools for growing strawberries in cold climates.
So we had a really cold winter. Our last frost was Saturday morning. I planted apple trees on Thursday and it sleeted on us. So we are actually really worried about our agricultural economy going forward. And so I really think there's a part and parcel of thinking beyond corn and soybeans. We have a lot of corn and soybeans where I live. And so I think strawberries actually have a really nice niche.
One of the priorities that we have in our program is to increase the regional supply and the seasonal supply of strawberries. And I think this project has really started to call a lot of attention to that.
All of the 20 current projects are about 3/4 of the way through a year-long study. The Walmart Foundation has given money for phase two of the initiative, and more proposals have already been submitted. Those recipients will be announced next week at the end of National Strawberry Month.
Environmental sustainability is an important cornerstone to our sustainability program. We're really trying to produce more high-quality, nutritious food with fewer of these environmental impacting resources that we need. So conserving energy, reducing the use of chemicals, alternative to those chemicals, and creating that kind of new mindset that we have for sustainability.
Rome says the reports yesterday from the grant recipients are very encouraging, but he advises that true changes in the strawberry production in the U.S. as a result of the current work still a few years away. But the current research is readily available for free to any and all interested farmers, horticulturists, plant pathologists, even backyard hobbyists.
We have actually several YouTube channels, and so the information, this information doesn't become dead after today. It's not going to be buried in academic journals. We've really tried to create information that will be used by stakeholders. So farmers, if they want to learn how to grow hydroponic or soilless strawberries, we have a whole YouTube channel
free
that is start to finish, nuts to bolts, that you can just listen to it and start to follow through and learn how to do it. We have the same on all of our projects, and a number of the projects have been very good of this kind of start to finish, nuts and bolts. How do you grow strawberries?
You can learn more about the National Strawberry Sustainability Initiative at strawberry.uark.edu.
Buttons can serve a purpose, keeping two pieces of fabric together or displaying a message. But they can also be a work of art.
You know, the thing about buttons is they don't have to be perfect. A button can be something totally unique. You know, there's totally one-of-a-kind buttons, and there's definitely artworks that deserve to be one-of-a-kind, and buttons can be that same kind of thing. They can definitely portray someone's personality through one button, or you can have a series of buttons. I mean, they can tell a single story, or they can tell different stories.
As we continue our locally made series, we visit with K&A Button Emporium. That's in just about 25 minutes here on Ozarks at Large.
I'm Robin Young. That ice cream truck song you may have loved as a kid, turns out it's got pretty racist origins.
There's tons of issues in our country today that have a racist component to them, and not because it's currently malicious, but because its history was founded at a time when the social norms were a little bit different.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now begins this afternoon at 1 on KUAF.
And this is Ozarks at Large. During the month of May, high school and college students don caps and gowns of varying hues and march down an aisle to pomp and circumstance. While students sit patiently, or perhaps more often impatiently, to receive their diplomas, they are typically addressed by a commencement speaker. Earlier this month, Melody Musgrove, director of the Office of Special Education Programs for the U.S. Department of Education, was the commencement speaker for the College of Education and Health Professions at the University of Arkansas. While she was in town, Musgrove stopped by Studio 123 to speak with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. During their conversation, Musgrove discussed how she prepares to deliver a commencement speech.
I love giving a commencement address. It's really a great opportunity, first of all, because I'm a teacher. You know, I was a classroom teacher. Both my parents were teachers. I have three nieces, and they are teachers. So I will always consider myself a teacher. So just an opportunity to get to speak with people who are just entering their field, whether it's healthcare or education, is a great opportunity for me. So I was really excited when Dean Smith invited me to speak at the commencement. But I think about, you know, what would have motivated me or inspired me whenever I was sitting in their place. Now, the first thing is to be brief, because honestly, I know they are just wanting to get that diploma and get out, so I want to be brief. I remember thinking when I was sitting in their seat that I wondered why we had to have a commencement speaker. Couldn't we just get our diploma and leave? But, you know, I've tried to think very carefully about what are the things that I would have wanted to hear or needed to hear now that I'm looking in retrospect. What would have been some things that I should have heard at that time. And I think, you know, one of the main messages is for them to really think for themselves. I think we live in an age when it is increasingly difficult to get to the truth. I mean, there's, you know, with the 24-hour media, there's just so much information out there. And nowadays, people have a tendency to either watch or read, consume the things that agree with their positions rather than really seeking to find the truth. And that's what I want to encourage the students tomorrow to do, is to think for themselves. Don't believe everything you read. And, you know, even if it's a professional journal, you know, read the research yourself. Dig into the data. Think about the way things work. There are many practices in education and healthcare that really don't have a strong background in evidence. Now, I want them to challenge. I want them to challenge the status quo, to be willing to call out, you know, whether it's improper practices, whether it's injustice. You know, I want them to be courageous. I think we need more leaders, frankly. And so I'm going to challenge them to be really strong leaders, whether it's a teacher leader, you know, audiologist leader, a principal leader, regardless of what their field is. We just need more people to be really strong leaders.
And as you said, you know, preparing for commencement, you think about your own commencement and kind of your path to get to where you are now in your education. And reflecting on that, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, how you decided to become an educator and maybe even particularly the field of special education?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the path that many people would think. You know, I know a lot of special education teachers who have known they wanted to be a special education teacher since as long as they can remember. As I said, I do think that education was a natural fit for me because my parents were educators. Both my parents grew up during the Great Depression. My dad served in World War II. They both grew up poor. There's no way my dad could have gone to college if it had not been, you know, for a grateful nation that established the GI Bill. And so he was the first person in his family to go to college. So he always believed that, both my parents, you know, just believed that it was the most important thing that we could ever do. And so I don't remember a time when I didn't know, you know, as a young child, I don't remember a time that I didn't know I was going to college. So number one, just they were such believers in education. And number two, my parents were both, we lived in rural Mississippi, and my parents were both real champions of the underdog. You know, if there were people in the community or children at school that, you know, didn't have the things that they needed, mother and daddy, while they didn't make much money themselves, they were always very caring and concerned about people that the rest of society seemed to have kind of forgotten about. So I think just that growing up in that kind of environment had a real impact on me. I actually did not major in special education as an undergrad. I majored in English, and I went and applied for a job. And I remember this is a long time ago, over 30 years ago. I went and applied for a job, and the school said, well, we don't have an English job, but we have a special education job. And back then, anybody who would take a class in special education, they would put you in there, and then people would usually hope they got, you know, another job doing something else. And I absolutely think it was fate. I mean, I immediately knew that it was what I was meant to do. I never looked at doing anything else other than special education from that point on. You know, parents would say, wow, you know, I just had a knack for being able to reach children. And I think having not been trained in special education, I came at it from a very different perspective. I came at it from the general ed perspective that all kids are kids first. You know, during that time, the special education was much more segregated than it is now. And so I began to look at the students that I had and thought, why are they in special education? I mean, they clearly have disabilities, but they can learn. Just because, you know, the vast majority of students that we serve in special education don't have cognitive disabilities. And so they can and should be achieving to high academic standards, but many of them weren't and aren't. And so, it was fateful that I was given that job in special education. It completely changed the course of my life. I love it. It's the only thing I've ever wanted to do, and I'm very fortunate to be a special ed teacher in my mind who works for the U.S. Department of Education.
Now, I'm sure a lot of our listeners aren't incredibly familiar with what your specific office does. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The Office of Special Education Programs is responsible for implementing programs under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA. And our programs actually serve children beginning at birth. The Early Intervention Program serves children from birth to age 3. And then the School Age Program, or Part B, picks up at age 3 and serves them into adulthood, age 21, or depending on state law, some states have laws that allow them to be served until age 24. So we have all of the formula grants that are administered. $11.5 billion of IDEA money is administered in our office. We have the formula grants that flow through to states and to lead agencies who provide the early intervention programs. We also have a discretionary grant program. We fund a lot of the technical assistance centers around the country and other programs that provide support to states. The PROMISE initiative that is here in Arkansas is also administered in our office under the Part D program. So that's basically what we do. We monitor and provide technical assistance to states on ensuring that IDEA is implemented.
And you mentioned having programs for children as young as infants, mm-hmm. and that seems just fascinating to me. What is the importance of having that early intervention?
Early intervention is absolutely critical. You know, making sure that children are exposed to experiences that enrich them, that enable them to develop and grow. It's important for all children, but for children with disabilities, it's absolutely essential. For instance, if a child has either a language disability or a communication disability or autism or whatever the problem might be, getting them intervention early is just so important because it enables them many times to enter school ready to succeed just like their peers. We actually know that we can prevent some disabilities. If students get some of the services that they need early, they can overcome those problems and be ready to start kindergarten or first grade on the same level as their peers. And we know that outcomes are improved if students get intervention early. If we identify what they need and can provide those services early, that life outcomes, long-term outcomes are often improved greatly because those early years are so important.
Special education seems like such a broad topic because no child is the same and they need different things. So how do you, create programs to fit the needs of such, a wide range of children?
Well, that's a great question, and that's why the law, IDEA, specifically says that each student will have an individualized instruction. So, yes, that's a challenge for teachers, but, we know that we can design curriculum and instruction in ways that enable the largest percentage of students to be able to access the content, to be able to demonstrate what they know and can do. So it is challenging, but, that's what special education does best, is individualize instruction and provide the kinds of supports and services that kids need to be successful.
Is there any particular programs or research out there right now that you're particularly excited about that's happening in special education?
Well, this field is always evolving. We've had, special education, what we now call is IDEA, since 1975, and we've learned so much through the years. What we know is that students with disabilities do best when they have access to the general curriculum and when they are held to high academic standards and they learn beside their peers, their typical peers. We know that they do so much better when they're in a very challenging and enriching environment. So some of the latest research that's out that's really fascinating is that when historically we have believed that the best way to teach reading to individuals with intellectual or cognitive disabilities was to teach them sight words. And so that's kind of the way we have focused our instruction. There's new research that came out last year that said that students with intellectual disabilities actually learn to read just like everybody else learns to read. So just teaching them sight words is not necessarily the right strategy. They just need more time. But there's been kind of this historic belief that students with intellectual disabilities might not ever learn to read. But now, you know, so the research that's kind of changing the way we practice is so important. And that's another thing that I want to encourage the graduates tomorrow is to really dig into what research is telling us. There's, you know, a lot of evidence out there about what works, and that's what we should be applying, whether it's in healthcare or in education.
In your current role, I know you've been working with accountability. You want to talk to me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I'd love to. That's kind of been my biggest, my highest priority there at OSEP. You know, when I began teaching special education, the total of my training that was provided by my school district was around compliance. You know, what do you need to do just to meet the legal requirements of the law? And so special education has always focused on compliance, on making sure that we got those procedural requirements right. But that has not translated into better educational outcomes for students with disabilities. Back in 75, when children were being prevented from attending school just because they had a disability, okay, that fixed that because we stopped that. The law did accomplish that goal. But it has not turned into better outcomes for students learning to read and do math. And like I said, most students with disabilities can, and they should be, achieving those skills. So now, instead of just focused on procedural compliance, we're going to be focusing our monitoring in states on how well are children learning. I mean, what are the outcomes? Are students with disabilities, as I said, how are they performing on reading and math and graduation rate? In most states, many states, there are really big gaps between the achievement of students with disabilities and students without disabilities. Now, I've been asked before, okay, well, I mean, they're in special education. Don't you think there should be a gap? The gaps are unacceptably large. Like I said, most students can learn to read and do math, but yet they're not doing it. And so, you know, and it's not their fault that they're not doing it. We're not providing the kinds of instruction and services that they need. The teachers are not getting the knowledge and skills and supports that they need to ensure that they can deliver instruction, to ensure that all children are successful. So it's a fundamental shift in special education. I mean, going from being focused on procedural compliance to also bringing into focus how well students are learning is a big shift. It doesn't mean that the procedural requirements are not important. They still are, because we have a legal obligation to protect the rights of children and families, ensure that they get the services that they need. But again, it's about bringing it into balance. We've been completely focused on compliance, and now at a national level, we have very high levels of compliance. We're at 97%, 98%, 99% of compliance with, you know, meeting the timelines that are within the law, ensuring that children get timely services, ensuring that due process and complaint resolution happens within the timelines. All of those procedural requirements we are doing very well on in general. But again, now it's time to focus on something else, as we did on those procedural requirements. What we focus on is what gets better.
And you mentioned that, you know, the teachers, they didn't have, like, the support that they needed to do this. Do you think that part of the problem was people not realizing, you know, that these students can learn more than what they're being taught? Is it just, I guess, going in with that mindset so you don't even try to look for other ways?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And it's not just in education. I think there's a general misunderstanding in this country about people with disabilities. I mean, almost 70% of adults with disabilities in our country are unemployed. And remember, that's people that just have a physical disability. That's not people with necessarily intellectual disabilities. So, I mean, that's just unacceptable. When you can't work, that translates into a life of poverty. So, again, this is the United States. We can do much better than that. So I think there is a general expectation in our country that needs to be changed. After World War II, when all the veterans were coming back from World War II, we saw a big shift in disability rights, in rehabilitation, in education that kind of jump-started the movement toward special education. So I'm hoping that now, you know, unfortunately, we have so many veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with injuries and disabilities, and so I'm hoping that we will see another revival in this country around making sure that we provide the kinds of supports as a society that people with disabilities need. My dad was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when I was a senior in high school, and he died at the age of 85, so he lived a very long life, my entire adult life, with very significant physical disabilities. So I watched the challenges that he faced, and I hope that we as a nation, you know, will come to provide. I mean, frankly, all of us are going to be either beneficiaries or victims of the system that we are creating. And, you know, what I hope is that we create a more inclusive and tolerant and compassionate society that really makes sure that those who need the support get it.
That was Melody Musgrove, Director of the Office of Special Education Programs for the U.S. Department of Education, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda earlier this month. She came to Fayetteville to deliver a commencement address to graduates of the University of Arkansas's College of Education and Health Professions. You can find out more information about Musgrove's office at ed.gov.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Karnatz.
I'm Kyle Kellums. The KUAF Summer Jazz Series opens its 16th season with the jazz fusion group The Yellow Jackets June 21st at 8 p.m. at the Eureka Springs City Auditorium. The Grammy Award-winning Yellow Jackets will present their high-energy mix of jazz, funk, and blues. The Summer Jazz Series presented by the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society. A link to tickets available online at KUAF.com.
KUAF will broadcast Mozart in the Museum live from Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art next Wednesday, May 28th at 8 p.m. Hosted by KUAF's Kyle Kellums and Katie Henriksen, this live broadcast will feature the Artisphere Festival Orchestra, interviews, and more. This event is made possible in part by contributing listeners of KUAF Public Radio.
Still ahead, we make our very own KUAF button, and the wrecking ball comes to downtown Springdale. But first,
time for a giveaway.
You bet. And we've got a pretty good package here to give away. Four tickets to any Malco movie theater in our region. Four vouchers that you can turn in for tickets to a game at Arvest Ballpark with the Northwest Arkansas Naturals. They're in town tonight, by the way. Lots of stuff going on at Arvest Ballpark for Memorial Day, including some special promotions that will raise money for tornado relief for Central Arkansas. And as just a bonus, some Wakarusa swag. Next week, we're giving away a whole package to Wakarusa, but I've got a koozie and some special Wakarusa sunglasses.
Neon pink. I like them.
Okay. So, well, one's pink, one's red, because we have two packages.
Okay.
We've had a story about strawberries.
Right, right. And in that, you mentioned that Arkansas at one point produced a lot of strawberries.
Yes.
For the nation.
Yes.
But now then, California is the biggest.
California and Florida by far produce more than any other state.
Well, I came up, I found, I have a question about strawberries in California.
Okay.
How many pounds did California produce last year in 2013?
So the two closest answers will receive the tickets, the vouchers, and the Wakarusa koozie and sunglasses.
All right, and you can send your answers to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
Coming up on Ask Me Another, NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia, author A.J. Jacobs reveals the little bits of wisdom that stay with you when you read the entire encyclopedia.
Like, I remember that Rene Descartes had a fetish for cross-eyed women. That's the stuff that sticks in there.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Guiltiest and Most Puzzling Pleasure.
Listen Saturday at 11 a.m. to 91.3 FM.
The button got its start in early political races and can be traced back to the very first presidential inauguration in 1789 for George Washington. But it wasn't until the late 1800s that today's design, with a pinback and transparent cover, was developed. Cassie Gross with K&A Button Emporium in Bella Vista now has quite the vintage button collection and says buttons go through all of the decades and are able to really capture a moment in time.
I had probably about a 20-button collection of just specialty ones that I had seen around I thought were cute or just interesting or nifty. I have one. It's a McCormick spice button from like the 60s, and it says, "I'm a pepper."
About halfway through a graphic design degree, Cassie was swamped with all of the typical college things, projects, studying, work, and had little time to work on her personal art and graphic design projects. Her then-boyfriend, Arden, suggested button making as a workable size and medium for an artist with hardly any free time.
And so my now husband came up with this great idea. He saw these button machines, and he just said, "I think this would be perfect for you to just do little works on. You don't have to feel like pressure that it's a big, huge thing you're going to mess up." And he just thought it was a great canvas and medium for my work. And so he spent the money and got me the machine, and we just went from there.
She was able to utilize her graphic design skills and software to make 2-inch designs. Her first ever applied to a button, three cat heads in varying neon colors. She also makes mini collages from things like images from old books. She scans them and reprints them as to not hurt the book, and then arranges them in a mish-mosh-posh way. Transitioning from a larger format to the smaller one wasn't too difficult. Cassie did find it less intimidating. The only drawback was found in working with business customers.
It's different sizing things for the button. If I have a certain logo or that I'm working with or things like that, I have to definitely account for the size and say, well, do you mind if it's modified a little? Or, I mean, what are your specifications for it being on the button? And usually people are just like, whatever, you know, whatever works. And that's what is really fun about it. I get to, you know, help other people and hear what their ideas are and collaborate all together. So it's a lot of fun.
She says button making is a great meeting people medium, as well as an artistic medium. K&A Button Emporium has been to various shows, such as the Little Craft Show and the Hip Handmade Market. Cassie wasn't planning on getting out her button maker at the first one due to liability questions, but then decided it would be fun to do on-the-spot button making with her customers. She has also been asked to do birthday parties where guests can color and design their own, letting their creative side show.
I know it's hard for me sometimes to think of all the different things I have going on and the artwork I want to create. And if I can help anyone do that during the day, that's great, you know. I feel like it frees people's minds when they can be a little creative every day. So it's just something very personable, and buttons seem approachable to me.
And the perfect button?
You know, the thing about buttons is they don't have to be perfect. Button can be something totally unique. You know, there's totally one-of-a-kind buttons, and there's definitely artworks that deserve to be one-of-a-kind, and buttons can be that same kind of thing. They can definitely portray someone's personality through one button, or you can have a series of buttons. I mean, they can tell a single story, or they can tell different stories.
Essentially, it can be anything the creator wants it to be, using anything they want to. The most time-consuming part of button making, she says, is the idea time, with the assembly not taking long at all. Cassie brought with her to the Carver Center for Public Radio two portable button machines, purchased new, though they bear a worn look from extensive use. The parts of the button are 1, 2, 3, she says. Today, we will make a KUAF logo button. Cassie has a logo printed out, and it was already a perfect circle shape, though we use a die cutter to cut it from its square page.
Okay, so then you just take your little round logo, which is, it's good when you're using your programs or whatever you're using to have a pre-cut circle, just to be able to tell where your design is. If you're hand coloring it or something, it's good to have the outline. And then you just center your logo into my little die cut. And it cuts it out perfectly. I don't have to do any guesswork. That's the nice part about that. And then a button is three parts. We have a metal front, a plastic. Some button machines come with a like a metal back, and it has a couple different parts. This machine we got, it's our first machine so far, and it has plastic backs. And then you also have a little clear top cover, which is called a Mylar. And then what you do is, this little handy dandy machine, is you put your little metal backing into the one side, which is called the die cut side, and then you line your little image that you're putting onto the button in on top of that, and then your little clear Mylar piece goes on top of that. You switch it over to the other side like you're about to press it, and then the backing has a little squiggle side, and then the side that actually punctures into your clothing to pin it to yourself. You want the squiggly side up. And then I'm going to let you do this.
Okay.
So I want you to push and pull, push this all the way this way.
Okay.
Yep, go ahead. You might think that it's too... There you go.
Oh, there we go.
Now lift it up.
Okay.
You're not going to see your button yet. You're going to switch the side.
And do the same thing?
Do the exact same thing. Okay, are you ready? You're going to have a button. You just made a button.
All right. Pretty easy.
Isn't it?
It is.
And it's fun, too. It's cool. Just a neat way to express yourself, for sure. And it can be a workout, too.
Cassie always wears a button somewhere on her person. And we'll be at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville for First Thursday, June 5th, beginning at 8 p.m. Perhaps she'll have her button machine, but definitely she'll have her buttons, including a mystery button box. For $1, a customer receives a surprise button in a cute paper pouch. For more information, you can find K&A Button Emporium at facebook.com/somesweetbuttons. This is Ozarks at Large.
Downtown Springdale's landscape is going to have an alteration soon. A warehouse at Main and Meadow, owned by the Art Center of the Ozarks, will be demolished so the ACO can create green space and parking for patrons. But before that warehouse goes down, there will be a wrecking ball party. Artists and musicians will combine for a one-time-only night of interactive art on the evening of May 30th. Yesterday, Tim Ferris, who is the technical director for the party, and Benjamin Del Shreve, one of the musicians scheduled to play, came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Tim says the organizers have decided to celebrate all kinds of changes for Springdale.
This building will be what they call razed or torn down at the end of the event. So it's a one-time event to celebrate the artistic community before we tear it down.
Ben, have you ever played in a place that you knew as soon as you were done was going to have the bulldozers come by?
That's a good question. I don't know that I've ever had that. I've treated stages like that was going to happen and got in trouble after the performance, but I don't think it's ever been an actual thing before. Yeah. I was thinking about that this afternoon. I was like, that is kind of a freeing thought. Like, of course, I'm playing an acoustic set this time, so I'm kind of missing out. If it was a full band thing, I guess that'd be a good time to kind of knock a hole in the wall or something like that.
Okay, yeah.
So poor me. I'm not going to hurt my ukulele. That'd be...
No, don't do that.
That'd be cutting your nose off to spite your face.
Yeah, just like rock and roll. Yeah. They're like, no, it's not.
Yeah. Well, Tim, as technical director, I mean, and you're putting together a venue in a place that is on limited time, what's going to be in there? You have carte blanche, I suppose.
Absolutely. I mean, so the whole start of this process was to clear some of the stuff that was in the building and then create this blank canvas. And, you know, it was seemingly already that way. We just had to get the stuff out of the way. And so, you know, the artists that have come in, Matt Miller, Sasha and his brother, and Sauer, just literally had a blank canvas, which was odd for them, and it's difficult to start. From what I understand, it's like a blank page before you start your writing process. So, yeah, it was really blank walls and creating that blank canvas for the artist to work, yeah. The wrecking ball, I feel like, is going to be one of those experiences because there will be so much stimulation, both artistically, musically, the food that's there, the people that will be there. All of those things will come together at one, you know, point in time,
yeah.
And that's important.
It's kind of interesting. You know, and it's definitely a constant muse of mine, but the idea of one's finality and letting that be a muse. You know, I read in a book, I think it was actually a Christian book, Wild at Heart. Okay. It was talking about there's no man more dangerous than the man who's reckoned with his own death. And I thought that was such a powerful statement, and that's worth living by right there, you
Absolutely.
Know? But when you actually realize this may be the last time you sing this song, this may be the last time you paint a picture, or... You know, for you know, the listeners out there or the people who aren't necessarily artists, how many people have you already seen for the last time? You may never know.
Yeah.
So you should always treat it like that might be the case and, you know, love.
Brings a little bit more passion to an experience, well, doesn't it?
The truth of the matter is that you always might be at your twilight.
Yeah.
One can never know.
No.
And you never know about those that you love around you, you know. Those grudges we hold that we think are so sacred are nothing once someone passes, and we don't realize it till then, sadly.
makes getting upset over that, not getting that parking space a little less important, right?
It's like, that was my parking slot.
Yeah. I'm going to pump the brakes and just keep my zen for now and just realize this is not a big deal.
But like Ben said, it's about love. I mean, that's a driving force. And love creates community and creates people coming together. Mm-hmm. That's extremely important, once again.
I don't mean any disrespect for this, what I'm about to say, Tim, but there are going to be people who hear this description. Okay, there's interactive art, there's Matt Miller, there's Benjamin Del Shreve, there's stuff going on in Springdale.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not, for a lot of people, especially maybe people who live outside of Springdale, that's not where they go.
Right. In their mind.
Thinking. Right.
But conceptually thinking, when you look at Northwest Arkansas as a whole, it's right in the middle of everything. So if we don't isolate ourselves to one particular area, then branching to that is not that difficult, either from south or from the north. And this is the first and the last one with the ACO Wrecking Ball. But for the area as a whole, I think keep that in the back of your mind, because it in and of itself is a blank canvas. And I live, work, and play all within the area. It's extremely bohemian, if you will. It's just a much slower pace. It's a nice pace.
Part of the bill at the Wrecking Ball Party on Friday, May 30th, is Benjamin Del Shreve playing solo. And yesterday, inside Furman Garner, he played a new song inspired by his newfound love of the mandolin and the role a local landmark played in helping him change his life.
It's a storyteller song. First verse is talking about my mom. Second verse is talking about youthful angst, you know, whenever you feel yourself kind of fighting with yourself because you just want to either conquer the world or burn it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Other part just talks about, very allegorically acknowledges my rougher time in life and how I acted. And then in finality, though, it ends me up on Mount Sequoia, where I would go, especially last summer on a regular routine, I would end up there meditating, just sitting quietly and just listening. And, you know, just saying, you know, speak to me, Lord, I'm listening. Speak through me, I'm willing, mm-hmm. you know. Keep my, you know, in my heart, my hands were up, just saying, you want to give me something, give it to me. You want to take it, you take it. You know, I'm at peace. Mm-hmm. And so the name of the song is Mount Sequoia.
Smile at me like maybe. Oh, when you need a sure damn thing. Mount Sequoia, Mount Sequoia, told me she had a baby Her body told me no such thing. She swallowed fire while I was singing. What a pair we'd make, like a circus. She's falling past an open window, like the sound of a football game, skipping across a quiet pond. Mount Sequoia, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mount Sequoia, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mount Sequoia, yeah, 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 I hear my train coming. I'll be getting on a plane. All my old shoes and dead flowers will expound upon my name, Mount Sequoia. Sunset in the rain. Guess I sought the shade. I sought the shade of a single tree. I guess I sought the shade. I sought the shade of a single tree.
Benjamin Del Shreve will play an acoustic set at the Wrecking Ball Party in the soon-to-be-extinct Art Center of the Ozarks Warehouse on Friday, May 30th. The warehouse is located at the corner of Main Street and Meadow Avenue in downtown Springdale. Also scheduled to participate that night are musicians Waterwalk, Unza, Woody and Sunshine, Chris Cash, and DJ Aboriginal.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blues Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday and meet Paul Thorne with a southern Mississippi accent, boyish charm, talking about his own style of bluesy rock. Paul came into the studio when he was in town last month, and he headlines the Friday night of the Fort Smith Riverfront Blues Festival, June 20th. Again, that's the Generic Blues Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
You could win tickets plus camping to the 11th annual Wakarusa Music Festival, June 5th through the 8th, on Mulberry Mountain in Ozark. Over 150 acts will perform, including the Flaming Lips, Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros, and the John Butler Trio. The winner will be announced May 30th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information available at KUAF.com.
Support for KUAF comes from Left Wing Physical Therapy, a source for manual therapy as well as education concerning posture, body mechanics, and general stress reduction. Left Wing also works with neurological conditions, including Parkinson's and stroke. Consultation and information available at 466-6910 or email therapydon@aol.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Bella Vista.
Don't forget, a contest if you want tickets to The Naturals, passes to the Malco movie theaters in the region, and some Wakarusa swag. How many pounds of strawberries did California produce last year? OzarksAtLarge@gmail.com.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Karnatz.
I'm Kyle Kellums. No, there's not someone new on staff. This is Christina Thomas, but over the weekend, you were married?
Right, right. And I have since become Christina Karnatz.
A lot of consonants when you and I co-host.
Right.
Kyle Kellums, Christina Karnatz.
Right.
Yeah.
I got a fun letter, though. I got a Z now. I earned
That's
a
true.
Z.
Yeah. That's true. That is good. All right. You and Antoinette together tomorrow.
That's right.
Very good.
And back on Memorial Day for a special edition.
That's right.
All right. Thanks for listening.